This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, welcome to Live and Learn with me, Darshan Johan. In 2016, Malaysian Bei Chiu Bu was arrested in Singapore for allegedly attempting to carry slightly less than 500 grams of meth across the causeway. He was sentenced to death in January last year by the Singapore High Court. But in an unprecedented turn of events, the 38-year-old managed to escape the noose when he was acquitted by the Court of Appeal in October 2020. However, that was not the end of the story. So today I'm joined via Skype by the lawyer Wong Siew Hong, who represented Chiu Bu throughout this ordeal. And we're going to be discussing the details of this case, as well as Siew Hong's thoughts on the drug laws in Singapore. Welcome to the show, Siew Hong. How are you doing?
I'm good, Darshan. Thank you for having me on.
Perhaps you can start by telling us what exactly happened. Take us back to 2016. How did your client, Chiu Bu, actually get tangled up in this mess?
That is a morality tale in itself, my friend. It's so simple. He borrowed his friend's bike. He was in a hurry. The weather was nice. His friend was probably was a drug trafficker, was about to distribute drugs. And then he forgot about it because the weather was very nice and rainy. He fell asleep. Bei went up to his house and said, oh, can bang on the door, said, can I borrow the bike? And then he just took off with it. And because the friend lived like 3 to 5 minutes away from the causeway, by the time the friend realized that, oh my God, you know, I've left the drugs in the motorcycle as well.
No.
And they tried calling him. Bei had already been arrested. And so, you know, the case just takes on a life of its own. And poor Bei then gets charged for drug trafficking, blah, 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 blah. Spends 4.5 years in prison, 1 year on death row. And all because he wanted to save 100 ringgit, a 90 ringgit. Because it was he originally wanted to drive into Singapore with his girlfriend. And that would have cost, you have to buy a 35 Singapore dollar day pass. That would be 100 ringgit. And for somebody who's working in Malaysia, 100 ringgit is a fair bit of money. And so if you were to ride in on a motorcycle, it's $4, which is 12 ringgit. You save 95 ringgit. For saving that $30, 30 Singapore dollars or 90 ringgit, the man spent four and a half years in jail and was on death row. Stranger than fiction. And the moral of the story really always, please check. You may be innocent, but still, right? The law, you know, like God is ineffable. They're relentless about it. You get caught with drugs and that's it. You know, you have to prove that you are innocent. It is so, so, so difficult because it is philosophically, you have to prove a negative.
Yeah.
That had absolutely nothing to do with the drugs. It's something that I just want people to reflect upon because, you know, we it's something we live with day in and day out. But based prisoner number on his, you know, they're all assigned a number, right? In the condemned block, because he was a condemned prisoner, was X, because that's for execution, 1021. Singapore, God. Small country. We've got 1,021 guys since records started being kept. They had passed through death row. We've got over 1,000 guys who have been sentenced to death. Not all of them have been executed. Some of them managed to get away, etc. But Bei, in a sense, is unique. Mm-hmm. He was the first and only guy that I know of who walked out completely acquitted.
You know, as you mentioned earlier, by the time Bei's friend realized what Bei was carrying, I mean, you know, that in his motorcycle, it was too late. Bei had already been arrested at the causeway. Yep. So what happened next? How did you get involved with the case? Did he reach out to you or did you find him?
No, I was assigned to him.
Okay.
Because, you know, these cases, they all start off, and mind you, again, it's a very, numbers tell a lot. Like I said, 1021, that he was the, you know, 1,000th guy who's been sentenced to death. His base in initial case number was HC, meaning High Court, 197 of 2016. Right? So in other words, he was the 197th guy that passed through, that was arrested with what was for a capital offence in Singapore. Mm. So eventually, if not all 197 cases would go on to trial. But it just actually tells you that a heck of a lot of these guys are probably maybe out of 197, very easily 150, 160 of them would be coming through from the causeway. They just get picked up. In other words, if you statistically break it down, say 52 weeks in a year, he was caught late October, going on. So, you know, it was probably in the towards the tail end of the year. If you statistically break it down, maybe probably be the, they would catch maybe one every other day.
Wow.
Yeah. It's actually quite horrifying because most of them would be these guys coming through on motorcycles. And literally, if you look at it that way, it's like Singapore is literally awash with heroin and all kinds of illicit drugs.
As we alluded to earlier, right, this case is incredibly unprecedented. We know that Singapore can be very, very headstrong when it comes to these things, right? Especially when it comes to their drug laws. They have been called ruthless. They have been called draconian. So when you took on the case, right, did you expect your client to be acquitted?
No. When I took it on, it's because, I thought it would be one of those box standard cases, right? They all come through, they get caught, and then they would say, look, I don't know a thing about it, I'm innocent, blah, 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 blah. That's a standard conversation.
Right.
We don't get excited about every client. That's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Because the thing here is that you would just have to be very cold, very clinical about it, and then say, hey, look, you tell me what's happening, right? Because if you lie to me, I can't help you, right? You tell me the truth, absolute, every word of it. Let me go and verify it, and let's see how we can cut through if there's a defense or not. If I feel that there is no defense, then perhaps I will get another pair of eyes. I won't do it. Tell me the truth. Mm. Right? And it's box standard. It's 197 of them, you know, and it's nothing unusual about him at all.
So what was your realistic expectations heading into it? What did you hope? Well, were you hoping to get like a lesser sentence? What was your expectations?
Well, unprecedented only in the sense of the outcome.
Mm. Yes.
But it was a box standard case going in. It was box standard.
So what did you expect the outcome to be?
Well, there was no expectation. Mm. It's just, okay, I'll take it on. Okay, I'll be candid about this. Mm-hmm. I took it on because it was a single defendant. When there are multiple defendants, this whole gang gets caught up. One, it gets messy. You'll get other lawyers involved. Each one of them would come up with their own story. Sometimes it gets a bit annoying because, you know, they end up fighting amongst themselves because they would push the blame onto the other guy and so on and so forth, that the trial gets extended. So I'd rather have a little clean, clinical one-man defendant sort of a thing. And let's see what we can do. We can do with that. Maybe might call it being lazy. That gone through, you know, all these multiple defendant sort of cases. I in fact just came out from one at that point. That's another story. I had just finished. My policy is I take on one case at a time. I just finished defending the Pakistani guy who was accused of murder outside Mustafa, who sawed his fellow countryman's body into two and stuffed it all into a suitcase. And that was a multiple defendant case. And so I just felt, okay, I'll take time to take on the next one. But for this one, let me do a single guy. And so, right, happened to be Chinese, not so much of a communication problem. I don't want to go and get to find an interpreter, so on and so forth. I could talk to him, single guy. seems to be fairly straightforward. Okay, let's see what we can do. Because the previous drug trafficking case, which I did, was also a single Chinese guy. I didn't get him off. He was convicted, but we negotiated it and we worked with the prosecution so that they would give him a certificate of cooperation. And so that was a two-tiered thing, either if he was guilty of trafficking, but he, we've also set it up so that he had already given his cooperation to the CNB. And we anticipated all that by making sure we shaped the evidence to show that, yes, he was in charge of the drugs. He had the drugs with him, but it was he had it only in his capacity as a courier. That is the law, the condition in the CNB, in the Misuse of Drugs Act. So we just made sure that, look, the court accepted that he was a courier, and so he was given 23 years. That was a good thing.
Siu Hong, you're sort of branding yourself in a obviously you're joking about are you being lazy, don't want to find an interpreter, things like that, right? Yet you managed to get Bei acquitted. So what exactly was your defense? How did Bei Chiu Bu get not a lesser sentence but acquitted altogether?
Well, it's a technical point, you see. Now, first things first, remember this. Something that a good friend who's a retired judge once said to me, the court is not interested in the truth.
Right.
It's a very broad thing. The court is not interested in the truth. If you want truth, you go to church. Where you come to court, you bring evidence. Now, so that's where we start. We need to get the evidence. What was my case theory? Our case theory, and this is what Bei told me, and so we had to, I had to verify every single point of it, was that that night it was raining. I was going to drive into Singapore and meet my friend, right, to return him his power bank, and we were going to talk about a job the following day on the 27th of October. Fine. And then when we were driving along out from Skudai over down into Johor Bahru, the rain stopped. So I said, I stopped over at Liu's house and I banged on his door. I said, hey, I'm going to take a motorbike. Now, that we could verify every part of it. How did we do that? We went elbow grease, right? Because we had to, basically, we went onto the internet. We went to Google Weather. We went to the Met Bureau. We actually had evidence of how the rain shadow moved from Singapore it moved northwards in the course of that night. Every 10 minutes, where was the rain shadow, right? And so that where it rained, where it was raining, where it stopped raining, and we were actually able to verify that with a reasonable degree of accuracy. I said, hey, or at that time, they said 10 minutes or so as he was driving into Johor Bahru, that yes, it stopped raining.
Right.
Because it is not because Bei says so, but it is the evidence that the Met Bureau says so. Google says so, and then after that, we have to, for example, another thing that Bei said to us was, we asked the question to him, you have another motorcycle. The motorcycle was broken. And why didn't you use your own motorcycle? The motorcycle was broken down, right? And so where was it? It was in a motorcycle workshop. And so I had to send my interns and my young guys into Johor Bahru. And, it's been a couple of years since. You know what Johor Bahru is like, right? It's quite chaotic. So it's like, where's the address? I can give you the street. House number?
No.
Name of shop? I don't think there was a shop name.
Yes.
Phone number of the guy? So basically, we just had to take a photo of them of Bei and just go knock door to door and canvas, right? And yet we never found the motorcyclist workshop, right? But the thing is that it has to be done.
Yeah.
And essentially, that is all in the evidence. That's how we got it. Because that's what Bei tells us. He didn't know. Mm-hmm. We then had to reconstruct the timelines and say match it against evidence. Because it's not so much, I say that this is that this is the truth, but as I said, in that sense, right, about God and going to church, right? You want truth with a capital T, you go to church, or you go to the mosque. But insofar as the court is concerned, if you want to persuade the court, you have to persuade the court with evidence. So we have to find the evidence.
All right. On that note, we do need to take a very quick break. We'll be back with more with lawyer Wong Siew Hong on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and with me on the show today is Wong Siew Hong, the lawyer who represented the 38-year-old Bae Chew Boon, who was arrested and later sentenced to death for allegedly attempting to carry slightly less than 500 grams of meth across the causeway. But thanks to Siew Hong's defense, Chew Boon was eventually acquitted of all charges, and that's what we are discussing today. So what are some of the challenges you faced throughout the case? What was the prosecution's argument?
A prosecution's argument was very simple. You have the drug. You had the drugs, so therefore you are. It was in your motorcycle. It starts off with a very simple proposition. You have the key to the motorcycle. Yes, therefore you are in control of the motorcycle, and if you are in control of the motorcycle, you are presumed to know what's inside the motorcycle. And so the drugs were in a plastic bag under a couple of rain jackets. And so you're presumed to know that the plastic bag was there, and you're presumed to know what was inside the plastic bag, and you're presumed to know that there's something inside the plastic bag, and you happen to know that these are drugs. And not only do you generally know that these are drugs, these are not drugs, and you know that these are not drugs in the sense that this is jamu or, you know, tongkat ali or some other thing, yeah. But you happen to know specifically that this is 500 grams of ice, and so thank you very much. Over to you. You proved that you didn't know.
But is there no consideration for the intent?
No. Because the intention is all based upon knowledge. And so as soon as they presume, that's why I say it's layered. It's like a kueh lapis, right? They layer the presumptions onto each other. And then right at the end, they say they layer the intention to you. You prove that you didn't know.
The devil is in the details, right?
Yeah. We say, and we've asked and maintained all along, that Bae, on this Bae's instructions, of course, that he did not know that there was a plastic bag in that particular plastic bag or a plastic bag at the bottom of the seat well, because he just opened the seat. There was a jacket in there. At the top, we thought that, okay, there might be another jacket on the bottom. So that was it. Slammed it down and went off. And so this is a philosophical point, that how do you prove the negative? How do you prove that he didn't know, right? And so that was where the miracle occurred, because the CNB officers, he said, look, right from the get-go, I never said any. I've always maintained that this. I don't know anything about the drugs. Please go and look for my friend Liu. The CNB officers said, look, whatever he said, we recorded, and he never said anything about Liu. The first mention of Liu was 3 days later, when he was in CNB headquarters. So, God be praised, right? There was this interpreter who came along and he pointed and asked him, say, hey, look, there was a half-hour break between the statements, right? You had a conversation with him. He said, yeah. I said, did he mention Liu? He said, yes, he did. And that was the first major breakthrough that we had, because the Chinese officer just happened to remember that Liu's name was mentioned. Now, Bae went on to say, look, he has said, please give me a phone. I will call Liu. Better yet, why don't we all go together back to JB? We will ask him. But I asked the officer, did he remember that? He said, no, I'm sorry, I can't. Fair enough. But the point is that at some point on the first day, the name Liu, somebody remembers that Bae had asked about and said, look, go ask Liu. And he wasn't lying about this. And he didn't start mentioning Liu until 3 days later. So that's an important consideration where the Court of Appeal was concerned.
Now, I read in some reports that ultimately it came down to a DNA test, and that was the sort of make or break for the case, right? So can you first tell me about how this DNA test came into play? What exactly did it prove? And also, if it came down to a DNA test, what boggles the mind is why wasn't the DNA test done, you know, before he was even convicted in the first place?
DNA test was done long time before. Okay. DNA is just a fancy name. It's a fancy name for fingerprint. They go put the super glue on it to say, because it's all plastic, and then you know all the they're all wrapped with masking tape and duct tape, and so all these people, whoever touched it, the fingerprints were there. Liu's fingerprints were all over the bags.
Right.
There were, in fact, there were three or four people, because they all bungkus the dada. So you know, must have passed through a few hands, and Liu's fingerprints were there. Bay's fingerprints were not there. Mm. Okay, if Bay's fingerprint is one fingerprint there, or even one partial that Bay's finger of one partial fingerprint was there, he would have to answer for it. The fact that Bay's fingerprints were not there just means that he didn't touch the drugs. It doesn't mean that he didn't know that the drugs were in the bag, or that he didn't, because somebody may have done the bungkus, right, and put it there, and they said, hey, you are just a delivery boy. The absence of his fingerprint doesn't mean that he didn't know. If his fingerprint was there, he mati-mati.
Mm.
Right? So that was the first thing. So the question then is this. Who can tell the court how the drugs got into the motorcycle?
Who?
Basically, I tak tahu. Right? I have no bloody idea.
Did you call Liu to stand to testify for Bay?
Well, they offered him to me.
Okay.
They offered him to me, and I happily said, okay, I'll take him on, because, you know, this is my story. I want him to prove the story. And then later on, at the last stage, when the prosecutor was questioning Bay, the last question that the prosecutor put to him, they said, I put to you that you are working for Liu. At that moment, the scales fell from my eyes. I said, oh my God, this is what they were going to do. Because this is their case theory. And so if I call Liu, I'm going to ask Liu, wait, tell me about the drugs. And Liu will say, I don't know, Babu. Okay, I got nothing to do with it. Okay, because that is what you expect him to do, and push everything. Because if he says, oh, yes, these drugs, yes, they were mine. I intend to send it in or whatever. The guy is going to die.
Right.
He's never going to say it.
But in your interactions with Liu, in that one interaction with Liu, did he try to, you know, like just deny everything and say that no, it's all on Bay?
Yes, of course. I don't know. Is he going to say, oh, you know, I he's my friend. I need to save him. Of course, he's just going to say, I don't know. In fact, when I first asked to see him, wrote in to see him, he told me, I'm a very busy man. I'm sorry, I got no time to entertain you in prison. I was like, what are you talking about? You know? But it was a lovely letter. I am very busy. I got no time to talk to you. But there you have it.
No.
So, natural. Right?
Yeah.
Strange thing. So, the thing here is this. If I called you, he would go and give me the same answer. I would then have to treat him as a hostile witness. And I would then have to apply to cross-examine him and put all these things to him that actually, you know, that it was raining, you were sleeping, blah, 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 and you forgot to take the drugs out. He is never going to agree to me. But then on the other hand, the prosecution, because Bay is now Liu is my witness, they would then, as a matter of right, cross-examine him and put all those things to him. That you and Bay had this plan to deliver drugs into Singapore. Bay was working for you. You know, Bay was blah, blah, blah. Not only would Bay die as a result of that, because there's absolutely no objective proof, but it's just the prosecution will be able to say all these things because my witness. On the other hand, not only would Bay die, he will die. Mm-hmm. So just when the scales fell from my eyes, I was like, oh, one foot is over the brake. I had to pull the handbrake, and then you can see smoke coming out from behind. I had to swerve. I said, okay. I am not going to call Liu because that's how it was. But we came that close. It came that close.
Now, what is what's the situation with the case now? We know that Bay has been acquitted. He's even back home with his family, has done a couple of interviews. Yes. What next? Is it over?
Insofar as Bay is concerned, yes.
Okay.
He's home. He's home in Penang.
Mm-hmm.
He's serving out his quarantine. So I was just on the chat with him. He's got a new SIM card, Malaysian SIM card. So And he's gone for his swab test.
I read that you were the one who bought for him his new phone.
God, yes. that was again a matter of necessity.
Right.
Okay, but well, there's another conversation. But, you know, when the press says he is free, I kind of took exception to that because it's like, yes, he is at liberty. They've let him out of prison, but he's free to go anywhere and do anything he wants in Singapore so long as A, don't require money.
Okay.
Right? He has got no money.
Right.
Two, don't require a trace together token or a what you can safe entry scanner software because he has neither of that too. So the poor fellow had to, you know, basically he was liable to be arrested if he tried to go into any building because he doesn't have, you know, money. No. So what would any common human being do, right? I got him out. I can't leave him on the road.
Yeah.
So first thing we did was give him some money, make sure that that he could he's not walking around absolutely penniless. And then secondly, then we went into a 7-Eleven and a Cheers mini mart, bought him 4 packs of instant noodles. 5 liters of green tea. Look, Babu, sit down. You go. I check you in the hotel. Okay, I get you a hotel room. You sit down there. You don't wander around. Okay.
Yes.
And actually, the far more distressing aspect of the whole matter because it's like the law I can control, right? But this thing is like, hey, there's so many moving parts with all the different agencies. Not anybody is trying to play punk because. But the problem there is that the it's just the reality where the rubber meets the road. You know, you say. Free, not really free lah, but you want to go home also, there is a lot of things to be done. So, insofar as Bay is concerned, he's got a couple more days of the quarantine to finish.
Okay.
He will be out this weekend. In Singapore, we are now waiting for the further judgment of the Court of Appeal on the issue of the prosecution raising the, trying to bring up the 4 charges that have been withdrawn. That was why he spent another 4.5 months in jail. So and then it's just basically mopping up the bits and pieces.
Okay, before the break, you know, we were talking about, you know, the laws surrounding drug trafficking in Singapore, right? Sion, do you think these laws are important and necessary, or do you think that they need some serious updating?
I will leave that for your view. Just say the what so. What is so, right? We have got the death penalty. God knows, 40, 50 years, right? For as long as I've been around. We've got one of the harshest drug laws around. And we still have 200 guys coming through with bags of heroin and meth into Singapore, you know, every year. So there are 2 sides to the question. Is it a good idea? You know, does it work? But I then invite you to consider, what if we don't have it, right? Because it is like, with the death penalty, you get 200 fellows coming through every year or more. But without the death penalty, imagine what it's going to be like, free for all, right?
Do you actually think so?
I think so. So I will say this. I am not a fan of the death penalty. But I also see it as necessity. I've got personal experience where you have these family experience where you have these so-called free societies where you can get drugs readily, etc. Many years ago, my niece, we sent her down to Australia to study. She was going home late in the evening. She was robbed and she was stabbed with a hypo by some druggie. And she was on AZT for the anti-AIDS drugs for 18 months. So, yeah, I am. You ask me, should there be harsh treatments for drug traffickers? The answer is yes. Whilst I'm in an ideal world, I would say we shouldn't hang people as a matter of principle. That's why I say I'm not really a fan of the death penalty. But on the other hand, I am not against it. If you were to ask me and go on to a national referendum, I would probably vote to keep it.
Okay.
Because we live in an imperfect world. Sometimes we need harsh laws to keep to keep the order.
But do you think these harsh laws, especially with regard to this, right, do you think it actually works? Because a lot of studies have shown that the people, a lot of times the people that actually get put on death row are not the kingpins. You know, yes. They are not the Pablo Escobars of the world and things like that, right? It's always low-level drug mules. Like you said, just coming in of Singapore a lot of times, just like Bay, they may not even know. Sometimes they know, but they are, a lot of times, you know, I was talking to another lawyer in another show recently, and she was saying how a lot of them, they come from poor families, they are financially not secure, and a lot of times they get manipulated by drug lords or you know, and say, you know, just bring this and I'll give you money. Just, oh, this is nothing. You don't have to worry about what it is. Just take it into Singapore. Very easy peasy. What's waiting for you on the other side is a lot of money. And so people who are desperate, people who are less informed, people, you know, in these desperate situations, they get manipulated and a lot of them end up getting on death row, but the vicious cycle doesn't stop.
I agree. But I think Singapore has made a great step forward in 2012 when we passed the amendments to the allowing for the courier defense, because it acknowledges the fact that there are vast majority of these guys are drug mules. Are mules. They've been used, they've been manipulated. You may say eyes wide shut, they knew what they were in for, blah, blah, blah. But still, we ameliorate the situation. For me, interacting with Bay gave me an insight. Although I've been in this gig for many, many years. Anyway, from a more theoretical, hands-off approach, because I was the lawyer, if the client gets sentenced to death, I don't have to live with him. But in Bay's case, it came through viscerally that they say, hey, he was sentenced to death. Incidentally, he was sentenced to death on Chinese New Year's Eve. Until after Chinese New Year, his hair turned white, lost a lot of weight. I don't know whether I asked him, I'm not sure if we're 7 or 17 kilos in the 2.5 weeks. It's serious a lot. Yeah. He aged. When I took him out from prison on for Chinese New Year, and he had a video call with his sister, the second thing she said to him was, "You've aged." It was very moving, because the first thing she said to him was, "I never expected to see you in this life." But the point is also that when he shared with me what it was like living inside the environment, it just brought back to me the readings I had when I was a student with Arthur Koestler, Reflections on the Hanging, The Executioner's Song, Norman Mailer, on that movie by Sean Penn, Dead Man Walking, right? I was talking to that. It actually became very real and very visceral for me. And what he told me was that all these guys, there are about 40 guys in death row in Singapore right now, right? He had to interact with them every day. And that was where the conversation about Dead Man Walking hit me so hard, because he said, look, as a theoretical proposition, now he's very blue collar, right? Chinese guy. Right? He said, look, we all know that we are going to die. But within that group, community of us, 40 out of us, we know that there's a sell-by date. We don't know when, after it's been confirmed, we don't know when the letter is going to come ordering you to be executed, but we all know. So in that, he had a breakthrough with his worldview, but nevertheless, coming back to it, it's a reality. Right? So whether they were manipulated, blah, blah, what are we going to do about it? It's we've always had it. And you, if you were to say, well, it's a bad idea overall, let's take it away. You know, I personally am of the view that it's just going to open the tap. We're going to be overrun with drugs all over. The issue is, I mean, I like it, but I feel that it is necessary. because I can walk down the street. I don't worry about, you know, guys coming up and stabbing me or robbing me because he's some crazy drug addict sort of guy. And for that, I've had the opportunity to walk around in Australia and where these things happen. And quite frankly, given a choice, I'd rather be in Singapore.
That is certainly very interesting perspectives that you share there. And you know, it's like you said, I may not, you know, be 100% in agreement with you when it comes to, like you said, when it comes to freedom, when it comes to, you know, the death penalty and things like that. But one thing I will agree is that these are very complex issues and there's no, you know, straightforward one-size-fits-all answer.
You're right. I agree with you because these are lofty issues. It's a big issue for people to debate, right? And ultimately, it is a political decision to be. Where I am concerned as the lawyer, I am where the rubber hits the road, right? I have a role there within the system, and I just make sure that I do my best for the client, and I make sure that the client, my role is to make sure that the client gets a fair deal.
On that note, Siew Hong, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was Wong Siew Hong, a lawyer who represented the 38-year-old Bae Chew Bu, who was arrested and later sentenced to death for allegedly attempting to carry slightly less than 500 grams of meth across the causeway. But thanks to Siew Hong's defense, Chew Bu was eventually acquitted of all charges. So that was what this show was about. We took a deep dive into the case. We also talked a little bit about the drug laws in Singapore and whether or not the death penalty, there's a place for the death penalty in today's day and age. So if you missed any part of this conversation or other Live and Learn episodes, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my. You can also look for us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. Once again, I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.